This podcast was recorded at the 2016 JAD Pro Live at App Show Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is Management of Patients with Skin Cancers, Basal Cell Carcinoma and Melanoma, and it is presented by Daniel M. Siegel, Clinical Professor of Dermatology at SUNY Downstate, and Brianna Hoffner, University of Colorado Cancer Center. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JAD Pro Live.
It's my pleasure to introduce our next session, the Management of Skin Cancers, Basal Cell Carcinoma, and Melanoma. Please welcome our speakers, Ms. Brianna Hoffner from the University of Colorado Cancer Center and Dr. Daniel Siegel of the SUNY Downstate Medical Center. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Learning objectives, you all know that. You've all seen the slides when you put this on your smartphone. And again, we want to increase your understanding of mechanisms of action on immunotherapy and treatment for melanoma and treatment of advanced basal cell. We've got new skill sets for you to apply and manage the adverse events. So we will also discuss pivotal role in the expertise of the advanced practitioner, which Brianna will do, and we will take it away. Now, I have served on Speakers Bureau for Genentech, the producers of Vismodegib, and for Novartis, the makers of Sonidegib, and I've participated in other advisory boards, and Brianna has nothing to disclose.
Unfortunately, no.
And we have nothing to hide. So let's get into it. A basal cell cancer diagnosis, important to make a diagnosis, because you make that diagnosis early, you won't be dealing with advanced disease. But again, it's the classic rodent ulcer, central ulceration, rolled borders, radial blood vessels, pretty distinctive pink to gray lesions, non-healing ulcers, non-healing red scaly areas, the shaving cut that hasn't healed since World War II. And why is it important? We're discussing advanced disease here, and advanced disease all starts out as one aberrant cell. Again, patients might have multiple primary tumors that may respond to therapy, and you may be challenged at times for using a drug that is costly. So do as I do in this regard. If you're thinking of using a hedgehog inhibitor, strip the patient down, mark and count up the other basal cells. It's a lot easier to justify to ensure that you've treated the index tumor and 75 others. It amortizes the cost. And again, just a little clinical review. This is from a slide from the talk I gave 2 years ago in Orlando. I would point out that I believe that the meeting organizers can make that available to you, that handout from then. It covers a lot more basics because we won't spend time on the basics. We have little time today, so we're going to try and truck along here. Advanced basal cell is a neologism invented by Genentech because before that, we had other less than scientific but descriptive terms. We talked about gigundos, honkers, train wrecks, people who crawled out from under a rock. Brianna and I were just talking about one who, he crawled out from his motorcycle, but
yes.
The big lesion on an arm. Again, these are, the sort of biggies that we used to look at and say, I can do it. I'm the macho Mohs surgeon. But again, was it the best thing for the patient? Before the advent of hedgehog inhibitors, it was, but not anymore. Now again, NCCN guidelines, the Bible for everybody. Suspicious lesions, you biopsy them. The high-risk ones are the ones we're concerned about. They're the ones that are more likely after procedures to treat them, such as standard excision. If you get a positive margin, you want to either go back and do Mohs, you consider adjuvant RT, and if that fails, you have a number of choices, none of which are great, except the hedgehog pathway inhibitors. If you do Mohs or radiation, you don't get it all, the same thing. You ultimately wind up at a hedgehog pathway inhibitor. And again, high-risk lesions. What makes them high risks? It's large size, bigger than 20 millimeters. This is the size on low-risk areas, bigger than 20 millimeters. But high-risk areas, the central face, around the eyes, the ears, the T-zone, small tumors bigger than 6 millimeters are high risk. Poorly defined borders, recurrences, because recurrences on basal cell are always interesting. You never know where they go. And you know that certain things don't happen, like cartilage invasion is uncommon, except if they've had prior treatment and someone has breached the perichondrium and you now have a conduit for tumor tracking. And of course, aggressive growth patterns. Instead of having this expansile balloon-like growth, you have little tendrils meandering along, single-cell strands, that if you don't get them all out, it comes back again. So follow-up for recurrences, frequent, every 6 to 12 months. And again, if it's local, you go to the primary treatment pathway once again. And metastatic disease, it can be surgery or RT, but more often than not, it will wind up these days with a hedgehog inhibitor. But keep in mind, metastatic disease is real rare. So, drugs for basal cell pre-January of 2012. We had cisplatin and 5-FU. It was mediocre at best. We had superficial basal cells could be treated topically with 5-FU and imiquimod, photodynamic therapy, vigorous cryotherapy, you know, lower cure rates. But again, nothing was wonderful. And 85% of these patients were disease-free at 5 years from that particular lesion, but 15% had the adventures of multiple recurrences. So systemic therapy, you know, what works? This is sort of fun mechanistically. And again, first we'll say there's money in bugs, and I mean insects, specifically fruit flies, America's favorite research tool, high school students to Nobel Prize winners. And you can ask questions like, how do eggs grow bodies? You know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? And it's, you know, the smoking chicken with a cigarette, but we won't get into that. So hedgehog mutants result in abnormally shaped embryos, and this is where the term hedgehog comes in. As we'll see in some photos later on, they basically, some of the mutants have little hairy-like structures on the tummy that look like little hedgehogs on there. And again, the hedgehog segment polarity gene is the one that influences normal development of these structures. And they're denticles, not testicles, on there. And they're just, again, rough bits on the outside of the larvae. In the 1970s, a couple of researchers isolated mutations in the genes that control the development of the segmented anterior-posterior body axis of the fly. Again, the parallel why this is important is this plays a role in developing the human embryo and in the development of basal cell carcinoma. And the work resulted in the discovery of genes involved in the development of segmentation. They got a Nobel Prize for that. And the Drosophila hedgehog gene was identified as one of several important genes that played a role. Now, here we have in the top the cartoon showing what the tummy of the larva looks like. In panel B, you see this scanning EM of the, you know, the normal one. And in C, you take a look, it looks kind of bristly there. It gives the sense of looking at a hedgehog, which are cute little critters on there. So there are multiple flavors of the hedgehog gene. Of interest today is Sonic Hedgehog, which can be made from certain perspectives to look just like the character. And it was actually named after the character Sonic Hedgehog by one of the scientists involved after seeing one of his kids' comic books. We'll explain the pathway very simply. We'll start out with a cell schematically. For a cell, we will use a cell phone and other common structures on there. So here we have the cell, and we have the patched protein up there, and here we have smoothened. And what happens is patched is inhibitory towards smoothened, and nothing happens. There's no smoothened-enabled signal transduction, and nothing goes on. Now, of course, what happens now if we have the hedgehog ligand bind to patched? Well, the inhibition goes away, and then the smoothened migrates up to the cell membrane, you get signal transduction, you wind up getting target gene expression. So, now, you say one thing, some people will say, by doc, is it natural? Now, interestingly, it's not natural, but it's modeled on nature. Nature has its own hedgehog pathway inhibitor, cyclopamine, and cyclopamine is found in the California corn lily, also known as the California false hellebore, the western false hellebore, and this is Veratrum californicum. It is, according to the California agricultural people, a weed on there. And it's a nasty poison that inhibits the hedgehog pathway. It causes birth defects in both animals, such as sheep, and it can do the same in humans. You can wind up getting nasty things. It is a nasty toxin. You can't treat with it because there's not a therapeutic window. But drumroll, oral hedgehog pathway inhibitors do have a use that outweighs the risks. So here we have that circumstance we just showed you, and lo and behold, here is our hedgehog pathway inhibitor. It binds to smoothened on there. When it binds to smoothened on there, transduction stops. There's no target gene expression, and nothing happens. And that's how these drugs now work. Vismodegib was first to market. Sonidegib came to market shortly after, 4 years after. The phase 2 study that got it to market was the one from the New England Journal. And that's important to remember, this got to market with only phase 2 studies. It was so good, the results were so dramatic, the government didn't insist on phase three studies, something I know is common in the oncology world, very uncommon in the derm world. It is rare for us in dermatology to have something that comes to market without extensive phase three studies. And again, the bottom line is that the patients were treated 150 a day, 150 milligrams, one capsule a day, until either the disease progressed or you had intolerable toxicity, and it made it to market on that study. Adverse events are common. When I sit with patients, I say, you will get muscle spasms, you will lose your hair, your taste will be altered and may even go away. Everybody wants to lose weight. Most of my patients haven't. It seems the older ones do. And the other ones are less frequent in terms of adverse events. You can also get constipation, arthralgias, diarrhea, and agousia. Always fascinating that one drug gives you both constipation and diarrhea. The amenorrhea may be irreversible, but outside of the basal cell nevus syndrome population, you're probably not treating a lot of patients for whom that is an issue. Some patients develop hyponatremia and hypokalemia and azotemia. The important takeaway here is that, you know, when patients wind up having, those, you know, I tell them diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, if you have that, get yourself to your primary doc, my office, or a walk-in clinic, and we give them an index card, and I write down, you know, electrolytes and BUN. Nothing really to follow otherwise on there. The spasms are interesting. Some describe them as cramping or pulls or twitches on there. Pickle juice works for some. Pickle juice is essentially Gatorade with salt. Massage can help, but that's costly unless you have a willing family member. A Valium is very effective. You might want to use Flexeril first for all the issues of controlled substances. And again, drug holidays. If you have the patient take a break for 1 month or 6 weeks, often the symptoms go away and they may be less troublesome after they come back. No specific labs to follow for Vismodegib, though Sonodegib does recommend a variety of labs that are in their label. And again, telling the patients if they get diarrhea or vomiting worse than what they might think is a normal URI or GI problem, then let the provider know, check electrolytes and BUN. Now, these are some pictures from that seminal New England Journal study, baseline to 20 weeks on that case, and again, baseline to 24 weeks, pretty impressive results. You know, big tumor, no tumor, or tiny tumor, or residual crusting, but really dramatic responses. Nothing drug-wise was doing that. As I mentioned, you know, Vismo first, Sonodegib 2015, and others are coming along. We have, you know, a variety of drugs out there. We won't spend time. You've all got the slides on here. Now, what's new? We'll cover some of ASCII. Well, they had the data that came out of the Mikey study that we were involved in, looking at a couple of different regimens to cut down side effects. One was a 3 months of daily treatment, followed by alternating courses of placebo, essentially a holiday for 2 months, followed by another course, and the other regimen was 24 weeks treatment, then 8 week on-off courses, and primary objective was looking at percent reduction from baseline at the end of treatment. Both worked well. Neither one really was much better than the other, though A had a numerically better outcome, and the safety profiles were comparable. No surprises. It was Stevie looking at an analysis in 1,215 patients in the real-world setting. Again, these patients, you know, were treated the same way, 150 a day until progression occurred. The primary objective here was safety. These patients were followed for 12 months after the last dose of drug. And look at these 165 sites, 36 countries, a big study. Your average patient was 72 years of age, interestingly, mostly men. And at the time of analysis, a third of them still were on the study. And lo and behold, that basically it showed that, you know, they had many complete and durable responses. Out of my alma mater, Albany Med, Jeff Ross's group did some genetic sequencing of metastatic basal cell and squamous cell cancers, and they found high mutational loads, no surprise on there. They found more cell cycle dysregulation in squamous cells that were metastatic and more hedgehog pathway alterations in metastatic basal cell. And again, another study looked at Sonodegib when it came out. This drug, when it was in trials, was looked at with two doses, 200 milligrams or 800 milligrams a day. This was a 30-month follow-up study on both doses, looked at median duration of exposure of about 11 months, and the overall response rate was about 56%. Interestingly, the higher, lower dose, but in the higher dose, may have had to do with compliance, is my suspicion on there. And again, similar responses regardless of histology. And again, the 200 milligram patients had a more favorable safety profile. And again, the reactions which seemed to be common to the class of drugs were the spasms, alopecia, and dysgeusia. Again, durable responses were demonstrated here. There was resistance demonstrated in a French case series of 207 patients. Nicole Seguin-Bassett performed that one. 10 centers. They had primary resistance in 10 patients. 18% had secondary resistance. It's not a surprise. But again, you know, this is oncology. It makes things interesting. So when some things come along, we just find the way around it, and we can discuss that in the Q&A. And now I'm happy to turn it over to Brianna.
Thank you. All right. So melanoma. The incidence of melanoma is rising. This is one of the few cancers that that's true for. It's rising especially fast among young women, which has spurred a lot of conversation about tanning beds, but probably it's multifactorial. So survival by stage here, you can see that really stage 4 disease has the worst survival rates. However, the 2C, there's really a blip there. Probably the reason for that is that 2C disease, as you guys know, if you're familiar with the staging of melanoma, includes in-transit disease. And so that in-transit probably is really behaving more in a metastatic fashion, and that's likely why there's such a significant dip in the 2C population. So in treating melanoma, we have a lot of different targets, and we've really been leading the way in the immune therapy conversations. But we also have the targeted therapies, and our hope, of course, if you have two things that work, why not combine them? So we are working towards that goal as well. So oncolytic immune therapies and checkpoint inhibitors such as the CTLA-4s and PD-1s, cytokines, they still have a place like IL-2, and then targeted therapies, and we'll talk more about all of those. So immune checkpoints in melanoma, this graphic is a great graphic from Dr. Olshansky, but he is going to talk to you guys next about immunotherapy in general. So I'm not going to belabor this point, just to see where these checkpoint inhibitors are working. Where is that CTLA-4 and where is that anti-PD-1 working? So there's like a central immunity with the CTLA-4s and then more peripheral with the PD-1s. And again, this is looking at the mechanism of action, but I'm going to let them talk about that in the next presentation. So T-VEC, which is an oncolytic immune therapy, this was really a new thing. T-VEC got approval just last year in October of 2015. So T-VEC is an attenuated live herpetic virus, and it's an intralesional therapy. This is something that's important for us to know about as advanced practice providers, because we can administer this treatment, you know, that is within our scope. And a lot of institutions, as they are rolling this out, are trying to figure out the best way to do that, and oftentimes we're the most capable of reading through the protocols and taking the time to inject these patients and treat them. So we will talk a little bit more about this, but essentially the way this works is you inject the live attenuated virus directly into the lesions that causes the cells to lyse, which causes this immunogenic response. We've seen that they can get a response not just at the site that you inject, but also in other lesions. For example, I had a patient who probably had about 100 in-transit metastases on her leg. We treated 8 of them because there's only a certain volume you can inject, and they all resolved. So it's not just the treated lesions that this can have efficacy. So approved immunotherapies, I mean, this is crazy, and then T-VEC on the bottom. But look at this, you know, if you look in the last 5 years, we have made so much progress, and that's really kind of the point that I want to drive home. We had the IPI, then the Pembro, Nevo, and then the combination most recently, as I mentioned, the T-VEC, which is not actually an immunotherapy, really, sort of. So survival in the first-line setting. You guys have all seen this slide. It's an old slide. This is from the New England Journal in 2011. The only reason I put it up here is to point out that in 2011, IPI was a real game changer. This was our first immunotherapy, our first checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapy, and it was significantly better than dacarbazine in terms of overall survival. The other thing that we learned from ipilimumab, which was a really important lesson, is that the immune therapies are durable. Patients who respond continue to respond, right? Because our question with these initial trials was, you know, what's going to happen long term? But these patients continued to be responders. So that was great, but we felt like we could do better. And so then we had Nevo. So this is from the New England Journal article in 2015. This is Nevo versus dacarbazine. So you remember those curves that I showed you with the IPI versus dacarbazine, and this is even better. Right, the Nevo made an enormous difference. A hazard ratio of 0.42 is just remarkable. That's the hazard ratio for death. So we looked at the pembrolizumab anti-PD-1 versus ipilimumab, the anti-CTLA-4, and we saw that the pembro has a higher efficacy than the ipi. So again, this theme of just building, you know, we've got something good, let's find something better. And that's why we combine them. So the CTLA-4 plus PD-1 versus single agent PD-1, and this is a conversation that's still sort of ongoing, not just in the melanoma world, but in other malignancies as well, as you guys know. And so we found that the combination probably works more quickly, and may have higher efficacy, especially in patients who are PD-L1 negative. However, there's a lot more toxicity with that as well, so it's something to consider. So, speaking of toxicity, immune-related adverse events, I'm just going to go through this briefly with you guys. So immune-related adverse events or immune-mediated adverse events is anything ending in itis, because itis just means inflammation. We are upregulating your immune system with these drugs, and therefore you can have inflammation anywhere. These are the common ones I have listed, which you've probably all seen, but there is a lot of very uncommon things for us to keep in mind as we treat these patients. So colitis, this is more common with the anti-CTLA-4 therapies than it is with the PD-1. However, if you combine PD-1 and CTLA-4, the incidence again sort of increases there, as you guys can see. The management of colitis is based on the grade and how significant it is. This grading is the CTCAE grading. So you can see that if a patient is grade 2 or higher, that you are going to need to intervene. You're going to hold immunotherapy starting at grade 2, and you would permanently discontinue immunotherapy, likely, for grade 3 or 4, sort of depending on presentation. Hepatitis is less common than colitis, but something to be very aware of. About 2 to 9% of patients. The clinical pearl that I would give here is that if you see a patient and they have elevated liver enzymes, make sure you bring them back within 48 hours, because you never know where you're catching them in that curve, and things can change very quickly. So if they come in AST, ALT of 500, start them on their steroids, bring them back in 48 hours. You want those numbers to be going down. If they're not going down, you may need to do higher dose steroids, IV steroids, or something else. So we sort of talked about this. Mycophenolate may be useful in patients who have the persistent hepatotoxicity. So again, something to keep in mind, it's not just your standard steroids. There are a few other modalities. Dermatitis. So we're pretty good at this. We got really good at this with the ipilimumab. It's more common, again, with the ipi than it is with PD-1, but again, the combination of PD-1 and CTLA-4 bumps that up above just the single-agent PD-1. This is usually your earliest toxicity for patients on immune therapy. There's sort of kinetics of toxicity, and the rash is generally what you're going to see first. So for management, it just, again, depends on the grade. You should use topical steroids, educating patients not to take long hot showers, baths, things like that. And then if it is severe, you need to use IV steroids or oral steroids. Antibiotics have not really been helpful with rash, just so you know. This is more of a macular rash generally. It's not that papular rash that we've seen with some of the other drugs that can improve with antibiotics. So endocrinopathies, this is an interesting one because generally this is a toxicity that does not resolve. I tell patients that I'm putting on immune therapies that we can treat everything, we can take care of it. The one thing that might not turn around is an endocrine, or likely won't turn around, is an endocrinopathy, such as hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, etc. Hypophysitis is an interesting thing because it's not something what we were really that familiar with as providers, or didn't have to be as familiar with as providers, prior to the start of using these immunotherapies for our patients. So hypophysitis is just inflammation of the pituitary gland. It can be very difficult to identify and to treat. I want you to know that I admitted my first hypophysitis patient that I ever saw for sepsis. They were not septic, obviously, but they can be profoundly ill. You know, that patient was sort of slumped over in the chair, not really talking. Their words weren't that clear. They looked horrible. Then, of course, just a little bit of steroid, and they were fine. But you can do an MRI with pituitary cuts, you can check their hormone levels, and you can work with your friends in endocrine to make sure that you're doing the diagnostic workup appropriately. So surveillance, the clinical trials have generally recommended that you check thyroid function tests every 12 weeks for patients on immunotherapies, although there is some variation in practice there, but the point is to make sure that you're checking them regularly. Time to onset of endocrine toxicities tends to be much later. This is usually the last one that you see. So rash first, endocrine last. It's not always the case, but sort of something to keep in mind. Management is hormone replacement or something like methimazole for a hyperthyroidism. The hypothyroid is more common than hyperthyroidism. We do not think that a pre-existing thyroid disorder puts patients at a higher risk of developing an endocrinopathy. There's a lot of other immune-related adverse events. Seriously, anything in itis. I've been telling people recently that we've been seeing like some plantar fasciitis. I've had 3 or 4 patients that have had that. You can get some weird neurotoxicity toxicities like Guillain-Barré or myasthenia gravis that can be very severe. You can get neuropathies with these drugs. They're all immune-mediated. You have to keep that in mind in your management, but work with your consulting services and with your colleagues and other practices to make sure that you're diagnosing these things correctly and working it up. And so you should always rule out all other causes of an adverse event before just assuming that it's immune in nature. However, steroids are going to be your backbone of care, and then there are other things such as infliximab or mycophenolate that you can use to mediate these reactions. Targeted therapies. So vemurafenib versus dacarbazine, again, the point here is just to show you what we had before and where we went. So these are the plots showing you that with vemurafenib, the response rate was nearly 50%. That's a single-agent vemurafenib versus dacarbazine of about 5%. So this was a remarkable change. This is from 2011 as well. It was a good year in melanoma. So then we wanted to combine BRAF and MEK. This is one of the few examples in medicine where combining two agents is actually less toxic than single agent. Any of you who have given a single agent MEK inhibitor know that it can be a real nightmare. Same with single agent BRAF, but when you put them together, patients really do tend to tolerate it better. And we see that the overall survival and response rates are better. So BRAF mutations occur in about 50% of melanomas. They do portend a more aggressive melanoma. The BRAF inhibitor single agent is about a 50% response rate, as we discussed. However, the problem is that we see an acquired resistance. With single agent BRAF inhibition, it's about 6 months is the median time to resistance. So the adverse events, the rash that you see with BRAF inhibitors is also generally more macular in nature. Cardiac here, this is important. They can get a QTc prolongation. So the BRAF inhibitors and the MEK inhibitors have different cardiac toxicities, but they can both be cardiotoxic. So make sure that you're checking EKGs on these drugs. Uveitis is something that we don't often see. You can also see that, of course, with immune therapy, since it's an itis. And they'll come in, they'll say, you know, my vision's a little blurry, I have a spot in my vision. Work with your friends in opto to diagnose that. You can do steroid eye drops for treatment, and it generally resolves. So AE management, as we just discussed. Other things that they get are the arthralgias. Those are a bit difficult to manage. NSAIDs or narcotics can be helpful, stretching, heat, things like that. And then hepatic toxicity, just make sure you're monitoring the liver function tests. Otherwise, we sort of talked about those. So MEK inhibitors, they have a lower single-agent overall response rate of about 25%. So use these in combination. Similar side effects to BRAF, but also you can get a retinal vein occlusion. So that's an emergency if your patient comes in and can't see. Make sure you know, if they really have a acute loss of vision in an eye, make sure you take that very seriously and get them to opto emergently. So for cardiac, for MEK inhibitors, it's a cardiomyopathy that you can see. So you're checking EKGs on the BRAF inhibitors and MEK inhibitors, you need to monitor echoes. So we talked a little bit about the AE management here. The diarrhea and the fevers are two other things that I should mention with the MEK inhibitors. Those can be hard. Patients have been so well trained about fevers that they often present to the emergency room. However, we see this with this drug commonly. So make sure you educate them that this can happen. If they're not neutropenic, which you would not expect on these agents, it's not the same medical emergency. They can take antipyretics. So BRAF plus MEK, as we discussed, it's more effective. The median time of response with combination is about 10.5 months. As we noted, the resistance with single agent BRAF is about 6 months. So these work better and they last longer. And as I said, the side effect profile is better. All right. So we wanted to sort of cruise through the introduction to basal cell melanoma so that we could get to the cases and really sort of get to some of the issues that we see in practice and talk about this with you guys and leave some time for questions. So our first case is our melanoma case. So we have a 58-year-old female with stage 4 melanoma with metastases to the liver and bone. And so we have decided to initiate her on the ipilimumab plus nivolumab. So one thing that I want to note here is that the dosing of the nivolumab is different when you use it in combination. You guys are familiar with dosing as a single agent. Recently, nivolumab went to flat dosing rather than weight-based dosing. However, in the combination, you use it as weight-based dosing when you're giving it with the ipilimumab. So she gets her first 3 cycles. And then on August 27th, she presents to the outside hospital complaining of fever, cough, and shortness of breath. So this is always sort of the case, right? We would love to see these patients at our treating facility so that we can evaluate them because we know the patients, we know these drugs, we We always feel like we're the experts. But it's hard to get to the facilities. A lot of our patients live far away, so very often you're having these conversations with emergency room physicians from outside hospitals. So your patient, their vital signs are okay. The heart rate's maybe a little elevated, maybe a little elevation respiratory rate. Oxygen is sort of borderline. Temperature is sort of borderline. There's nothing here that's particularly stands out at you as alarming. The chest x-ray, which you guys can probably all read after your radiology session yesterday, shows a right middle lobe pneumonia. And so this patient is started on Augmentin every 12 hours by the emergency room clinician. So 3 days later, back in your office, good news, got your hands on the patient, but still doesn't look good. She has low-grade fevers, cough, and now she has diarrhea, which started on August 29th. So this is the thing, this is the reason that we have this case in here, because this is really hard, you guys, this is complicated. You know, you would like to think that we're going to have one thing at a time to manage. We're never that lucky. So the patient now, respiratory-wise, has issues, and GI-wise, has issues. She denies sick contacts, no dietary changes. She's having 8 loose bowel movements a day, not having any relief with Imodium, and the cough is making it difficult to sleep at night. So really, this patient's looking kind of punky. So this is from the Common Terminology Criteria for Adverse Events, the CTCAE. There is an app for that. If you guys don't have it on your phone, it's free. You should. It makes it much easier to understand these toxicities and understand your management of these toxicities. So if you look at the definitions for diarrhea, an increase of 4 to 6 stools per day over baseline is grade 2, and grade 3 is an increase of greater than or equal to 7 stools per day over baseline. And then under pulmonary for cough, you have for grade 2 symptomatic and narcotic medication indicated, or grade 3 symptomatic and significantly interfering with sleep or ADL. So this is why it's important to use the CTCAE and really ask your patient these questions. So she told you she can't sleep because of this cough, right? So according to that, she has grade 3 diarrhea because she's having 8 bowel movements a day. So that's over, it's 7 or more above her baseline. She generally has 1 bowel movement a day. And then she has a grade 3 cough because this is interfering with her sleep. So now that we've graded them and figured out what's going on, we don't know what the cause is, right? What are our differentials here? So that emergency room clinician put her on antibiotics. So does she have diarrhea because she's on antibiotics? A lot of people get diarrhea on Augmentin, right? Or does she have an infectious diarrhea, right? We can't forget that these patients can get C. diff even though they're not getting hospital treatments. They still are at risk for those infections. Or is this a colitis related to immunotherapy? And then with a cough, you know, the clinician in the outside emergency room felt like that x-ray looked infectious. So it could be infectious, it could be inflammatory, it could be irritation. So you really have a wide differential. So you need better imaging at that point, and that's when you would order a CT scan of the chest and the abdomen pelvis. So this is her CT scan of your chest. You can see that she has bilateral patchy infiltrates. This is a very characteristic pattern that you see with a pneumonitis. And then the abdominal CT scan, very profound. You can see that there's really significant thickening of the lumen of the bowel there. Can you guys all sort of appreciate that? Sorry. So you can see, like, this is the lining of the bowel, and so that is much thicker. You shouldn't really be able to sort of see the two sides of the bowel. It's usually just, like, one line around the bowel. So she's got a lot of inflammation there. So we believe, then, that she has, tripping over cords, a grade 3 colitis and a grade 3 pneumonitis. So what would we do about that? We would initiate steroids at a milligram per kilogram of solumedrol or the equivalent. The reason we're going to do IV steroids initially is because she has this very significant colitis, so her ability to absorb anything is really diminished, right? If you give her oral prednisone, she's going to poop it out. She's not going to absorb it. So start with the IV steroids so that you get some activity, and you can always transition to an oral steroid once the patient is feeling a bit better. Taper slowly. You give her a week of a mg per kg of steroid, and then you take her off. All these things are going to rebound. These are grade 3 adverse events. She has 2 immune-related adverse events, and so you want to treat it appropriately. You're going to taper it slowly. Consider antibiotic prophylaxis, right, because she's already got something going on in her lungs, so she's at significant risk to develop a secondary infection, and now I'm telling you that we're going to put her on high-dose steroids for a prolonged period of time. So those of you who work in bone marrow transplant, for example, you know that we always prophylax. Don't forget to do it with our solid patients who are putting on these long-term steroid doses. And we're going to have to discontinue her immune therapy due to the grade 3 adverse events.
Thank you, Brianna. Next case is an example of treating the patient, not necessarily treating the disease, but doing what is best for the patient here. 98-year-old white female, yes, 98 is correct, presents with a basal cell that had been excised from her nose 8 years before presentation to my office in August of 2013. The patient was well-oriented and communicative. She had her two younger sisters who lived with her, accompanied her, and the surgeon who did the original surgery told her that the margins were positive, but she didn't think it would be a problem, so she shouldn't bother coming back in her lifetime there. A year later, she had bleeding along the suture line. She had one more surgery, and she had radiation therapy over the subsequent 3 years. Past history was notable for other non-melanoma skin cancers. She had a pacemaker for decades. She had a history of congestive heart failure. Medications included warfarin, but in my practice, seems everyone's on warfarin, and folic acid and etanolol. She's also on digoxin. Over the preceding 5 years, she became reclusive as the appearance of the lesion and the associated fragrance deferred visitors. Family visits became quite infrequent. The only people who got to see her during that time were her sisters and her nephew, who was a dermatologist. Everyone else would speak to her by phone or would sort of drop off the map. She was referred to me by her nephew, who's a dermatologist in a few states away, because her primary derm was not comfortable giving her a hedgehog inhibitor due to her age. And I was the closest person he knew to her who would see her and treat her despite the age. Now, this is interesting. The patient lives, as you can see, in New York City in Queens. My office is in Smithtown. It's about 45 minutes by car away from that. And if one looks, you would find that within a four-mile radius of her home, there are 48 dermatologists. Between her home and my office, there's probably about another 75. But nobody would touch her. So here she is on August 29th. Now, again, from my perspective, now this is a nice basal cell. It's surgically manageable. But again, she doesn't want surgery. And this is what she's been sitting with for 5 years now. And so we take a close look at this. And what are the markers to look at? She has alar retraction. The alar is pulling away, which could be a sign of scarring from a prior procedure or the tumor infiltrating and causing contraction on there. She's got some atropine in the lower lid starting out. She has no nodes. And if you palpate it, it's bigger than it looks. So again, this was one that you might call a honker, or the new terminology, an advanced basal cell. We had an extensive discussion. Age and cardiac history might preclude surgery, might not, again, if you're a cowboy. But removal of the nose would result in loss of valve function. No nose, you don't have pressure against the lungs as you exhale. The lungs collapse, fill with fluid, and, it could do the patient in. In any event, she didn't want surgery. So we had more discussion. She already had maximal radiation to the area. So she left with lots of info. I took the Vismodegib brochures, the only drug on the market at the time. And as I do with all my patients, I started a hedgehog inhibitor. I highlighted things. I pointed things out. I try to educate the patient to cut down on, the Saturday night 11 o'clock phone call. We get a few phone calls over the next few weeks to talk with the patient and her sisters. She came back in October to see me. The reason being that she was starting to bleed more. She agrees to start Vismo that day. We obtained a confirmatory biopsy to show that indeed this was a basal cell, not a squamous cell cancer. Despite one's clinical certainty, often you have to do this to make insurers happy. We found infiltrative basal cell cancer, no surprise there. Well, she begins treatment about 2 weeks after the visit. Here's what she looked like on October 7th. Not much change in the tumor, just a lot of blood and hemorrhagic crusting on there. Again, pretty much an interesting tumor. It's pretty extensive. And we get a phone call in mid-December. She's starting to lose weight as her appetite's going away because food just doesn't taste as well. And her sister's concerned she's been getting fragile over the past few years. They're concerned. So, hair loss was not a concern, though it was happening. She had no muscle spasms, which was uncommon. I expected to hear about that. Almost everybody does. She was the first patient I treated who didn't have the spasms. And we all agree, no difficulties. Take a drug holiday. It's an easy drug to say take a holiday on. Unlike melanoma, basal cell cancer is slow growing. We have more flexibility. So we take a drug holiday, and she comes back in January. She had a wonderful holiday season, hang out with family and friends. She had her 99th birthday in early January, and she was eating again. She feels good, but no desire to go back on the drug. And an exam, she had some focal crusting, no palpable tumor. There she is on January 13th. She was missing a bunch of her hair, hence the cap that someone knitted for her. Pretty good result. Again, the alar retraction might have gotten worse as the tumor healed in, as the area healed in following tumor ablation on there. But just again, sort of comparative before and after, pretty darn good response. Now remember, she didn't start this until, about October 20th. So you think October to November, December, so 2.5 months, pretty impressive response. And this is what patients typically do when their responder's on there. You know, pretty good response on there. She's doing well, and she passed away a few months later, probably cardiac causes, not related to drug. Family was overjoyed. I got presents from various family members that they were able to hang out with her, see her, other than communicating by phone or Skype without the video on. You know, they were able to hang out with their aunt, and it was wonderful. They were all happy. And again, she had that long interlude that we had shortened up. Again, an example of, you know, that age is not a limitation, and it's reasonable. And I did point out in the beginning what was so important, that, you know, she was fully competent with it. Because if someone came in and she were out of it, if she were obtunded, you know, I would think, why are we doing this? But in this case, you know, the patient was involved in the decision. She wanted to try it, and it was a success story. Thank you.
All right. So we left time for questions. We said we would leave 5 minutes. We left 5 minutes and 2 seconds. I think we crushed it. So what questions do you guys have for us? I think Annie has a microphone. Yeah.
My question was about your presentation, and both were wonderful. Thank you. So suppose your patient has, you know, a side effect level 3 with the diarrhea, mm-hmm. but she admits she didn't take anything for it, which I can't believe often happens, but it does. So what would you do then? Would you insist she, you know, would you hold it a few days, insist she treat it and resume? Or what would you do if they just hadn't treated the side effect?
Well, you know, once you get to a grade 3 toxicity, the treatments, you know, your first steps when they're at grade 1, of course, as you guys know, is dietary modifications. So you cut out everything fun, no alcohol, no caffeine, no dairy, there goes the ice cream, no spicy, you know, it's sort of a nightmare. And they can generally get better with that in Imodium, as you know. You're right, we get a lot of patients who have a grade 3 colitis. They are, you know, still eating all of those things. They haven't touched Imodium. And then it's a question of what you do. But because they do have a grade 3 toxicity, they're really at risk of a bowel perforation, which can be a sentinel event for them. So I would discontinue the immune therapy and treat it as a grade 3 toxicity. And this is where it's important for us as APPs to make sure we educate patients well, to tell them, let us know early, because we can intervene and we can help you. But if it gets to a point of being a toxicity that would take you off treatment, we have to do the safe thing for you.
And you would never resume it like 2 months later. Okay, thanks.
Thank you for that excellent presentation. In your case one, mm-hmm. is there a particular prophylactic antibiotic that you would recommend, particularly in light of her ongoing diarrhea?
Right, I know. Good question. So a lot of times we'll do just the standard Bactrim 3 times a week dosing, because that way you're not getting as many of the GI toxicities, not hitting their marrow with the Bactrim, things like that. So usually that's okay. Sometimes we'll put patients on like a Levaquin dosing depending how tenuous they look. But you're right, the thing about that is that you have the potential to make the diarrhea worse. If the diarrhea is, you know, truly just entirely related to the immune-mediated adverse event, then the antibiotic isn't going to make much of a difference. So depending how they respond to antibiotic therapy, but it's a good point and a good question. You really can get down a rabbit hole with, you know, one treating one thing and running into more problems with another.
Hi. Just a quick question. So we've been doing the dual Ipi-Nivo, mm-hmm. and so we'll see, you know, after cycle 2 or 3, we've been seeing grade 3 colitis or grade 3 hepatitis. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do after giving a significant break with steroids and after tapering off of steroids is coming back in with single agent Nivo. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
So that's a really good question and a really good point about the toxicities with combo therapy versus single agent, because they are much less a single agent. So I think that the answer to that question is that we don't know. However, you guys are not the only ones doing that, trying to come back to a single agent after having a significant toxicity with a dual blockade. So I think that with very close monitoring, you know, my opinion is that with very close monitoring, that's reasonable. I have seen that work. I have seen that be successful with patients. But it's something, you know, you have to be very careful. Once you know that they have this immunogenic potential, they are always at risk for developing other IREs. Yeah, hopefully we'll get more information on that as we have those combinations in use longer. Yeah.
I just wanted to point out, and thank you, that was an excellent presentation, that both companies, the companies that make those drugs have little pocket cards, and we have patients that come from a long distance like you do, so it's really important to give them that little card with your number on it so the ER doc from outside can call you, because many of them are not knowledgeable, and I personally had a patient who ended up with a colostomy because she kept reporting to an outside ER. It was too far for her to come to us. The outside ER did not come, you know, did not call us. And she ended up with a perforation and colectomy, colostomy, and then subsequently a stroke because of the situation. So if we can really get patients to carry their pocket card with our number, and it gives all the information about how they should be treated if they have grade 3 AEs, particularly the colitis issue.
Absolutely. So the BMS drugs do have the pocket cards. BMS came out with that with the IPI, and it was something that was very helpful. And so they did that again with the Nevo. I can tell you that all of the companies, all of the manufacturers of these drugs are looking at what we can do better for patient education and for patient materials that they can have with them. You know, we've talked about all kinds of different things, like a fob on your keychain and a bracelet and the cards. And, you know, I've gone to a bunch of different meetings. It's been impressive. I can tell you that there are a lot of non-branded initiatives to get better at these immune-related adverse events and people understanding immune therapies. So a lot of the nonprofit organizations are sort of coming together with the support of drug companies, of course, to make sort of guidelines and information so that hopefully we have less of these issues down the line, and also initiatives to educate community physicians who are or are not in oncology and emergency room clinicians.
Concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.